Today on Rockin' the Suburbs, Jim and I take a day off and turn over the mic to our friend and expert podcaster, Nate Scott of The Sneak.
On June 26th of this year, the rapper G-Eazy released a new record called Everything's Strange Here. It was another successful project for the wildly successful rapper, who already has multiple top 10 Billboard releases, a People's Choice Award, and nearly 9 million followers on Instagram. Everything's Strange Here was a record meant to show a new side of the rapper, which in music industry parlance means he sings on this one. But for a select group of people listening to this album, and I include myself in this group, it wasn't G-Eazy's singing voice on the record, or the featured appearance from his celebrity girlfriend Ashley Benson, that stood out. Rather, it was the eighth song on this record, a song called Every Night of the Year. Every Night of the Year stood out because it's a song that was written over a decade ago. And when we first heard it, we were in the city of New Orleans. G-Eazy was there for it too, actually. But back then, he was known as Gerald. And he was just another kid in the crowd.
Every night of the year, the dancer confronts a fear.
My name is Nate Scott. I'm a reporter who hosts an investigative true crime podcast for USA Today called The Sneak. The story I'm telling today isn't about a crime, however. Well, it's more of an abstract crime. The story I want to tell is about a music scene that popped up in the city of New Orleans during the late aughts, a scene that I was lucky enough to live through and be a very, very tiny, tangential part of. As to why I want to tell this story, well, let's talk about Meet Me in the Bathroom. If you're a serious music fan, you probably have at least heard of, if not read, Meet Me in the Bathroom, an excellent oral history written and compiled by Lizzie Goodman about the New York scene in the early aughts that launched the careers of The Strokes, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, LCD Sound System, Interpol, on and on. For this show, I want to explore a similar explosion of creativity and music in one city, but one where the bands didn't end up with gold records and on the cover of Rolling Stone. And I want to investigate why that never happened. Why a scene that produced so much amazing music never quite caught on. I know this has happened countless times before in music history, across a wide swath of cities, and it's only rare, NYC in the aughts, Seattle in the 90s, Liverpool in the 60s, that it overlaps with commercial success. This is not really a unique story, but it's one I lived through, and one I want to tell. For Rockin' the Suburbs, this is a special episode called Lost Scene, Nobody's Fault. To start it off, we have to go back to when the world ended.
The governor of Louisiana said today that she is considering the remarkable step of evacuating the remaining residents of New Orleans. A water main broke, leaving New Orleans without drinking water, and the flooding here is getting worse after waters from Lake Pontchartrain broke through a levee.
I came back right after the storm in 05.
Wait. First, sorry. Introduce yourself first. What's your name?
Hi. My name is John Michael Ruchel. I was a, or am a, was a singer-songwriter, music producer from New Orleans, Louisiana. I was born and raised in New Orleans. I grew up here, started playing music when I was 10 years old.
John Michael was a NOLA native, and the guitar lessons he started taking at age 10 soon got serious. Really serious. He became somewhat of a local prodigy, and played in bands in high school with guys who would become New Orleans legends, including John Batiste, who's now the bandleader on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. After high school, John Michael enrolled at Loyola, the local college known for its music program, to study the craft. But pretty quickly, he joined a band, and the band started touring.
So I dropped out of school, did a year kind of touring, doing a bunch of stuff, which was great, and things were looking really good. And then this little storm happened called Katrina.
Turn to the city that Kev forgot. My city was forgotten. and I'll be too. But I'll return to start anew.
I felt like I needed to be back here just because this place was had given me so much, and it's home.
With the city still more or less in ruins, John Michael re-enrolled at Loyola in 2006. And while up until that point he'd been a guitar player, he'd found himself being drawn to the art of songwriting.
When you're 18, you find out about Jack Kerouac, and you find out about Bob Dylan, and you find out about, you know, Keats and all this stuff. And so all of a sudden, all of that time I spent sort of just playing guitar, all of a sudden I wanted to tell stories and write songs.
This new iteration of John Michael's musical self had a new name, and he kept it simple. My name is John Michael.
And so the My Name Is thing came about. It was 2007. I spent a lot of time kind of tinkering around with, like, you know, one or two microphone thing, and started to like listen to myself sing and record and stuff.
Dedicated to improving his craft, John Michael started writing, recording, and releasing songs at a dizzying rate. And his influence for the project was a bit unexpected and perfectly New Orleans.
Kids from New Orleans, like the Hot Boys and Cash Money, were like our heroes. So like seeing Lil Wayne's sort of mixtape model and this idea of sort of quantity. And so I wrote this marketing paper at Loyola, where basically I decided like I was going to do a song a week for a whole year, and that at the end of it, I would let people vote and pick what the album was going to be.
It was a wild idea at the time, and in the early days of music blogs, it seemed almost revolutionary. That 52 Songs in 52 Weeks project is how I first heard about John Michael, though I actually heard about it from a music fan friend in a different city. This was weird, because at that time, I attended Tulane, a college right next door to Loyola. Though anyone who attended the two schools will tell you, they're actually a world apart.
Tulane and Loyola are divided by one street. But it's wider than the Mason-Dixon line as far as like mindsets are concerned. Tulane, from the vantage point of a Loyola student in 2008, was like the rich kids, Northeastern sort of Ivy League South kind of thing, you know, that kind of vibe. And Loyola felt like this, you know, it's a Jesuit school, so it has this kind of like gritty, kind of a little bit more middle class feeling kind of thing.
Loyola also had a music program.
The music industry kids, like we were this weird little traveling circus of freaks.
They may have been freaks, but they were also incredibly talented musicians. Musicians that John Michael soon started recruiting to his band.
It kind of piecemealed, like, little by little. But then, like, at some point, you know, that kind of, like, that Bob Dylan mentality of, like, just steal a band kind of kicked in. And so I was just like, okay, I'm just going to steal musicians from other bands. Like, you know, that I just think are talented and I like.
With a loaded pool of talented musicians to choose from, John Michael stacked his band. What started as a guy, a guitar, and a blog started growing and kept growing. Inspired by the Arcade Fire, John Michael wanted to create an awe-inspiring live act, and he did.
All of them could have led their own bands. You know, I think it was like a 6-member band or something, but like everybody in the band was just this kind of really a musician with a ton of depth.
That's the voice of Greg Rodrigue, who's one of the other important people to know in setting up this story. He and his friend David Ray, better known as D-Ray, who I also interviewed along with Greg, were similarly from Louisiana. And like John Michael, they felt the call to come home after Hurricane Katrina.
I went to school at Millsaps in Jackson, Mississippi for like a week. And I pretty quickly was just like, I'm not in the right place. I don't belong here. And I went back to New Orleans when it was still under martial law, and there was curfews, and there was huge parts of the city that didn't have power.
You're about to hear the voice of D-Ray.
Definitely like a big deciding factor was friends and family, because you know, I also was like, well, I could go to do the Loyola Chicago thing, but, you know, my mom, my dad, my grandma, like, they're trying to deal with this shit.
The two also had a band.
It was basically like, well, if we get back to New Orleans, we can keep the band going. The band at the time was Fatter Than Albert. And that was our, like, ska punk, like, jazz core, whatever. And I was like, high energy, fun shows.
While Fatter Than Albert was pure adrenaline DIY ska punk, and My Name Is John Michael was taking folk music and blasting it out into a full-on roots rock symphony, both bands were committed to one thing above all, the live act. Here's John Michael again.
The canvas moved kind of from this web project of like a guy and his feelings into like, oh wow, like I want to make like the biggest racket I possibly can.
That racket was pretty literal. On one of their best-known songs, The One, the band brought a trash can on stage and would smash it with chains.
That song, The One, really, it's an organ pad, which is just kind of filling out space. My guitar, my voice, and like a big marching bass drum. So like, if you close your eyes and think about Mardi Gras and when a, you know, like a marching band passes you, like when St. Aug passes you and you hear, bo!
I am the one, I am the one.
The whole goal with the percussion stuff was to kind of create sort of that cacophony thing. Like I loved brass bands. I loved all those things. And I was trying to hint at that. You know, I don't think because it was like a bunch of white kids in skinny jeans, like we fully fulfilled the promise of that. But at least in timbre, I think we got, you know, those kind of sounds out.
I can stare at you for days. And if you say that I'm not the one.
John Michael, Greg, and D-Ray were Louisiana natives who returned home after the storm to make music that, in its own way, took influences from the brass sound of New Orleans. But what of the next generation? The kids who came to New Orleans after the storm? To willingly move to a city that had been all but destroyed, you had to be your own person. You also had to be a little nuts. I'll start by asking you to introduce yourselves.
Sure thing. Yeah. I am Coda Gerson. I lived in New Orleans from 2007 to 2014.
And I'm Kayla Green, the other half of KG Accidental. We were radio DJs on WTUL New Orleans, 91.5 FM.
WTUL is Tulane's radio station. And for those of us in and around the scene, KG Accidental was the best show out there.
I made my decision on where to go to school based on the city, not the school. So for me, going to New Orleans was a place where I was going to have access to music and culture, and that was my top priority.
Coda and Kayla were two of the kids who came to the city in the aftermath of the storm, and once there, found that some of these other newcomers were starting up bands. Some at Tulane, but most over at Loyola next door with their excellent music program. And there was one band there that, even then, stood out immediately. What was your first kind of exposure to this indie scene, which had its own little place in New Orleans?
So one specific show comes to mind, and it is the first time I saw Cattywampus. It was January 30th, 2009 at Tipitina's. I went to see this artist D1, and on the same bill, the weirdest bill of all time was D1, My Name Is John Michael, and Cattywampus. So Cattywampus went on first, and my mind was blown.
So
the second they went off the stage, I ran over to the merch booth and said, I need everything that you're offering.
Just the fact that two people could make that much noise was incredible.
Oh, you got to hear these kids.
That's John Michael again.
And it's two of them. I was like, oh, two of them. Okay, great. Because there was a lot of two of them bands. You know, this is post White Stripes, all that kind of shit. But then I saw these kids and it was mathy, but it was like super musical, super sad.
Everyone remembers their first Caddy Wampus show.
That's the voice of Dennis Sager, lead singer of Arc Animals and Bent Denim. He was in New Orleans at the time and remembers Chris Rehm, lead singer of Caddy Wampus, for how influential he was.
If you watch all the New Orleans rockers, when everyone kind of has a little Chris Rehm body language when they freak out.
Once again, John Michael.
He was so pure and authentic, and like, I think people could really see that. A kid with skinny jeans and Vans and an oversized t-shirt running his guitar through 3,000 pedals. And like, it was funny. Chris was very much an archetype.
The only other person in Caddy Wampus was the drummer, Sean Hart.
Sean was just an engine.
The only other person I've ever seen, at least on YouTube, that could hit that hard was John Bonham, like, of Zeppelin.
The songs that they were writing felt different and special and loud, and they were punk, but it wasn't necessarily hardcore music. It was just the feeling that they gave you and the aesthetic of these two guys face to face on stage, just going back and forth at each other. Until that point, you know, I had been kind of an indie rock kid, and that was getting into a whole level of music that it was just the next step. They were different and they were cool, and you couldn't ignore it.
Hey y'all, we'll continue shortly, but before we do, I'm going to shamelessly plug my other podcast and play the trailer for The Sneak. Then we'll get back to the action. In season 2 of The Sneak, a podcast from For the Win and USA Today, we will tell the story of surfing champion Jack Roland Murphy, who in 1964 pulled a heist that made him the most famous jewel thief in the country. But that was just the beginning of his story, one that quickly spun out of control and then turned deadly. The Sneak, Murders at Whiskey Creek, is available now on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or experience the entire series right now, ad-free, exclusively on Wondery Plus. Download the Wondery app and hear all of Season 2 today. Caddy Wampus burst onto the scene, but they weren't the only band in that new batch of kids in the city. Here's D-Ray again.
It was like 1 minute, it was like, oh, this band Caddy Wampus is about to move to New Orleans and go to Loyola. And then I blinked and we were sharing a house with Sun Hotel.
Sun Hotel was made up of classmates of the Caddy Wampus guys, and they quickly started releasing music and playing shows in New Orleans. Their music was big, bombastic, and for the neighbors downstairs at least, way too poppy.
I remember that Sun Hotel was a tough pill for me to swallow.
Really?
And I say that, lovingly, because I love that band now. But I remember I was coming out of more of like an aggressive style of music.
Sun Hotel's music was undeniably beautiful. But the trick was, you had to listen to the lyrics.
The last song that I was thinking about that meant a lot to me too was that song they do, Honey.
That's my friend Riley Flaherty, a music fan from New York who I introduced to Sun Hotel.
I remember hearing that song for the first time and being floored by it. But, you know, if you don't really like pay attention to the lyrics, you don't really realize what it's about. So I remember telling my girlfriend at the time, like, listen to how beautiful the song was. And she was probably focused on the lyrics. And she's like, why are you sending me this song? Why are you showing me this song? It sounds like it's about a divorce and like something really heavy that's going on. Oh, right. But it's gorgeous. You understand that it's still a beautiful, beautiful song, right? Like,
I got a damn good lawyer, and you won't get a thing. So when we get to court, you're gonna hear my voice ring. I got a damn good lawyer.
The reason I thought it was important to talk to Riley for this was that he was one of those people from outside the scene who helped me feel not so crazy about it. He didn't know any of these bands, had only visited me in New Orleans a couple of times. He had no fealty. But here he was, an outsider, hearing this music and saying, "Oh my God, this is so good."
When I first got introduced to Sun Hotel, which is obviously through you, and you were in New York, I remember getting a text from you saying, "Hey, there's this great band. Let's meet, and then we'll go over to the show in the Lower East Side."
Sun Hotel was playing a now defunct venue called Cake Shop.
Cake Shop was a tiny hole in the wall. Upstairs is a narrow, you know, beer covered sticky floor, and downstairs you go, and there's a 10-foot wide stage. And just playing their instruments as if they couldn't think of anything they'd rather be doing. And seeing Tyler and just how much emotion he performs with.
Tyler is Tyler Skerlock, the lead singer and songwriter for Sun Hotel.
He's barefoot, you know, and just, it's amazing they're not smashing into each other on the stage. But it's, even if the stage had been larger, I'm not sure they would have, you know, wanted to be even more separated. They just seem to have such a good cohesion in that band. And even though they were, all of them had different projects and bands they were performing with, it just seemed like this really great community they fostered and wanted to be around each other and wanted to make music together. It was awesome.
Sun Hotel truly seemed to love playing together, but I wanted proof. So I called up their guitarist, Al.
My name is Al Hertz. I'm a designer these days, but, you know, formerly a musician and still yeah, every day and always a musician.
Al was a guitarist who had started school at the University of Delaware, but he felt the pull to New Orleans and Loyola.
I came down, I went to school, and that's where I met Tyler. I met him on my first day for orientation for like transfer kids. And he invited me to come make some music with him, and so we did. And at that time I was really into harmonizing, and I felt voices that were easy to harmonize with. I think the way we sang worked well together. And so we started making songs, and I was really enamored by the like ideas of the South and like the stories of the American South. And he, with his literature lean, had all these beautiful songs he was writing.
Armed with Tyler's swamp gothic lyrics and Al's harmonies, the two quickly put out an acoustic EP. But then, like John Michael had done, they went recruiting, and they soon added Ross Farb, an unbelievably talented multi-instrumentalist who would go on to found the bands Native America and Video Age. For us geeks in the scene, it was like another supergroup had formed.
Ross, like, was always, like, having to do lots of different things. He had to keep it all together. Whereas, like, I'm just playing guitar and singing. It's so much more standardized. He was, like, I remember I would look over from him time to time, and he was, like, you know, juggling a lot.
Ross played keyboards, mandolin, guitar. And sometimes he'd just bang on a tom-tom drum up at the front of the stage. For indie fans at the time, especially New Orleans, it was a somewhat familiar sight.
It was the popular thing to have, was that multi-instrumentalist, mostly percussionist. It just made for good music.
It's almost now like it became a joke, like, oh, they've got an extra floor tom. Here we go, boom, click, boom.
That's John Michael again. His band had arguably the most charismatic man in that multi-instrumentalist role, Leo DeJesus, whose frenetic energy and signature mohawk perfectly complemented John Michael's soulful singing.
Which, great. I mean, it was a good idea. And Leo was the guy who could fill it. He was so talented and charismatic, you know.
Another notable member of the floor tom multi-instrumentalist fraternity was Tiff Lamson of the band Givers, a band kicking around at the time who scored a minor hit with Up, Up, Up. It was Cattywampus, Sun Hotel, and Givers. But then bands started splintering off of them. Here's Coda again.
It's so incestuous. So these bands would then offshoot and, all right, Sun Hotel, then we get Native America and Video Age. And from Newgrass, we get Habitat. And then every year, a new Loyola class starts and we get new bands. So then we got Arch Animals and Glitch, and then Donovan Wolfington. I remember the first time I saw Donovan Wolfington. It was in a backyard show. I don't know what had been going on, but I had definitely been drinking all day. And I have a love for the band The Anniversary. And they hit the stage, and I was like, oh my God, it is the New Orleans version of The Anniversary.
The origin story of us, like, being aware of Donovan Wolfington. Honestly, I think about that very specific moment, like, all the time.
That's D-Ray and Greg again, and in what is a recurring theme, the two weren't impressed with Donovan Wolfington the first few times they saw them. But then they got their hands on their first album, Stop Breathing.
And I remember they sent us the record, and I literally remember thinking, like, damn.
Greg and D-Ray liked the album so much, they asked to put it out on their label, Community Records. Simultaneously, the Cattywampus and Sun Hotel gang had started up their own label, Chinkapin Records. If the rest of the world wasn't interested in putting out this music, these guys would do it themselves. And there were so many bands to choose from. The band Pope came along, and Glish. The Revivalists blew up with their nostalgic sound. The Generationals were living in NOLA and getting some indie buzz. Cardinal Sons, High in One Eye, All People, Vox and the Hound. It seemed like every time you turned around, a new band popped up. And the thing about New Orleans was, there were enough live music venues to support all of them. Here's John Michael.
Unlike Boston, unlike Seattle, unlike Portland, unlike Athens, Georgia, where there's two venues, a venue, we could go play One Eye Jacks on Thursday of this week, and then next week we're opening for, you know, name your favorite New Orleans act. We also had Blue Nile, the Circle Bar, Tipitina's, on High Ho, on and on and on. You could even play the Saint.
New Orleans had lots of live music venues, and if you could play all right, and more importantly, bring a bunch of people around to buy beer, you could play constantly. And with most of these bands booking themselves, or just getting whoever was available to fill out the bill, some of these lineups were truly, truly bizarre. Genre didn't matter. Fan base didn't matter. A folk opener followed by a punk second act and a rap headliner wasn't just a possibility. It happened all the time.
In a healthy way, it made our shows ridiculous because I think all these bands, Cattywampus, Sun Hotel, us, I mean, even, you know, he's now a superstar, but like he worked out his show in clubs was G-Eazy. I mean, like he would be on these weird bills with us. Like we would have, you know, weird jazz band, like all these things you could just constantly play in New Orleans.
We loved playing live.
That's Al again from Sun Hotel.
In fact, in the beginning of our playing, we didn't practice, we would just perform. And that was like, you know, playing out is such an ingrained part of New Orleans culture to just go out and play. No matter what, you don't have to be perfect. Like, just get out there and share and bring that energy to the community was just something that people did. And I think there hasn't been, maybe in comparison to other cities, as much of a focus on like, we need to nail this set before we go out and play it. And we're going to play it the same way every night. And it's going to be great. Bands did that. And I certainly respect all the bands a lot that did. And, you know, I think the bands that were tighter definitely approached it that way. But I think there wasn't as much of that happening in New Orleans as maybe other places.
With all these strange bills being put together, the bands started influencing each other in really weird, strange ways. This is me and John Michael talking again about the Whoa Whoa Whoas. They also did the kind of the Whoa Whoa Whoas thing that was big at that time, which you guys were another sort of pioneer of that.
We were a Whoa Whoa Whoa. We were a Whoa 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 band. Yeah, I mean, I think for whatever reason, I think people like, I think, you know, I don't know. I don't want to pontificate on it too much and make it too gross. I mean, because it's just woes. I mean, it feels good. It sounds good. But I think if you think about the time, New Orleans is about a bar one night. It happens. Magic. You hope for that one fleeting moment kind of thing. And so I think it's a quick It's a quick way to create a community.
For bands playing in dive bars in New Orleans, where half the crowd would be fans and half would be drunks who wandered in off the street, a well-placed whoa-whoa-whoa would guarantee an instant sing-along. It came from the live act, but it showed up in records at the time, too. Native America did it. So did Donovan Wolfington. Cardinal Sons traded out the woes for oohs, but, you know, same idea. And then there was my personal favorite, Pope, who said screw it and just went with an While there was some calculus to these sing-alongs, Al wanted me to know there was a pure joy in these moments, too.
I think it was the first time we all had, like, really found people to sing with. And when you do that, it's there's no greater feeling than, yeah, like, it feels amazing to be locked in playing guitar or bass or piano and, like, sensing each other person's note perfectly, feeling really locked in with them with an instrument. But with your voice, with your body, it feels like you're in touch with whatever spiritual force you want to be in touch with. We weren't consciously saying, like, guys, I want to get back in touch with the deeper sense of connectedness and belonging that I get from harmonizing. No, but we were doing it a lot, and I think that came from that. Like, because even when I remember just, like, walking, you know, from point A to point B in the city, wherever it may have been, and I used to do it with Chris Ream a lot. Like, we'd just be singing, and we just harmonized just because it felt good. And so I think a lot of that was, it was like, it just felt physically very nice to do. And people liked it. So you like to be loved, right?
Yeah.
We love to be loved. We love our music to be loved.
I'm waxing poetic now. Luckily, I had Coda to bring me back to the investigation.
The ultimate question here is, why didn't New Orleans break out as a scene? And my theory or question is that even possible anymore? For with the accessibility to music on the internet, can a city break out like we saw in the 90s and the early aughts? Or is it just hope that one band will cut through and bring some people along for the ride? I don't understand how at least one band didn't do it. But I mean, we did get G-Eazy and the Revivalists. They're making it huge. But in our little indie corner, I think we all really thought Cattywampus could do it. Any of these guys were talented enough to do it. But as a scene, was it even possible?
There was a couple different times where I thought, okay, there were just moments. It was like these glimmering little moments.
That's John Michael again.
I remember a couple times with the Caddy stuff. Like, they got picked up on, like, a couple tours where I was like, oh, shit, here they go. Or, like, I remember Sun Hotel, similar kind of thing. And I was like, oh, this is it. Here we go. And it just, nope.
Here's Greg again.
I mean, we were always hoping it would happen with Cattywampus. You know, and I still even think that the potential is there. I just always thought that they kind of had what it took to break through to the greater consciousness. And Donovan, well, I mean, a lot of the bands involved with Community Records had it for sure.
D-Ray agreed.
It's like defending your children or your best friends. Like, I think all of them, you know, is like the obvious answer, but it's true that, like, at some point or another, I feel like any of these bands, I've been like, damn, I can totally see people freaking out about this band if they just, like, get access to it or get given a chance to, like, be in front of a lot of, you know, music fans.
Coda and the guys bring up a wonderful point. Maybe it was just that. Maybe it was the wrong time. These bands got unlucky. But something else happened too.
There were a lot of producers, record producers, who came down here who will remain nameless, but just they wanted, like, okay, your song should be a little bit more, you know, sound. And now the sound, you know it like the back of your hand. It's like that ukulele, hey, what about putting a girl in your band and singing harmony? And hey, what about if, what if the, you know, what if we kind of made this a little bit more, you know, sound like a YouTube ad? The industry was looking for this kind of like smiley, everything's great, you know, Obama, hope, everybody's fine. Don't look at the problems. Like, we're just going to ignore all this stuff. Like, New Orleans is rebuilt, right?
Those producers then went and found other bands to work with. Bands that you've heard of. Bands that took the sound of My Name is John Michael and put it in a crisp, poppy package.
Hey, I belong to you, you belong to me.
The first time the Lumineers played New Orleans was the morning, that afternoon, I got invited by you and I's friend, Brett Dykes, editor-in-chief of Up Rocks. They were playing at his house, like in his apartment, for this live set thing. But it was this really bizarre thing. I had never heard of this band, and someone was like, oh, I think you'll really like them. And I showed up to Brett's house, and it was like, oh my God, they're like, this is, they're doing like our thing, but it's just like kind of like all Monkees-ish. Like it felt like the Monkees. It felt like this, like the 60s, like pop, which is fine. Like I love the Monkees, don't get me wrong, but like you're right. Like all that kind of sad, all that ugly, all that kind of dirt got kind of wiped off of it. And like, I guess it was weird. We were caught between two spaces. We weren't indie enough for the indie kids, and it wasn't pop enough for the machine. And I think, you know, to the theme of this podcast, that's kind of why we got lost in the like middle.
I'm alone. Oh, I'm all alone. Well, you can't paint a picture when you're all alone. No, you can't paint a picture on the telephone. No, you can't paint a picture when you're all alone. No, you can't paint a picture. Sing it with me, y'all. Y'all are 1, 2, 3, 4. Ooh, whoa.
I was feeling good about my investigation. A combination of timing, luck, and some dastardly actors had been responsible. But then, at the end of our conversation, Al Hertz rejected my entire premise and made me think about all this in a very different way.
We loved New Orleans. We loved our community. We loved what we were doing here. And that might have distracted us from really pushing beyond the boundaries of New Orleans' gravitational pull, you know, might have prevented us from reaching that escape velocity you need when you're trying to exit atmosphere.
I had been looking for someone, something to blame for these bands not breaking out of the mainstream. I hadn't really considered that, for Sun Hotel at least, that wasn't what they wanted.
There was still like a DIY punk rock ethic to what we were doing, and it may not have served us at the time or been serving us, but like to some effect, like we romanticized the idea of staying underground. I know Tyler in particular, like, you know, it mattered to him in some respect, like when I would be more interested in, thinking about the band as like a business that, you know, is just going to sustain your life. That wasn't something that came naturally to us. It wasn't something that really made us excited.
It was in this moment, talking to Al, who couldn't have been nicer, that I felt very foolish. I'd been looking for the perpetrator of a crime that had never occurred.
You know, we were excited to play shows and to interact with the fans we had. And when it became a business, it felt icky.
The moments in New Orleans I witnessed, the ones I got to be a part of, they were in part special because they were experienced just by me and those around me who truly cared.
I think there's a lot to that New Orleans where there's a sense of worthiness in that place about art where it's like, I don't need to take this art outside of the city to feel like it's justified. It's just, I'm just making it and I'm having the best time I can.
And as Alex patiently pointed out, a lot of these groups did succeed. G-Eazy became mega famous. The Generationals and Revivalists scored hits and are still touring. The Givers got a ton of buzz. Down in the Ninth Ward, Alinda Lee Segura was making music at the time as Hooray for the Riff Raff, and they'd become critical darlings. The bands that wanted to break out, who truly went for it, often made it. And for everyone else, we'd always have those moments in New Orleans. If anything, it made those nights even more special, because they belonged to us, and us alone. In 2018, Donovan Wolfington announced they were ending the band. They put on their final show during Community Records' 10th anniversary party, put on by Greg and D-Ray. Jeff Rosenstock actually came down to play it. Coda and Kayla flew down for it, and just about everyone was there. Well, almost everyone. I couldn't make it, but I was delighted that shortly after, someone posted a video of the entire set online. I've watched the set dozens of times, and there's one moment I find myself returning to over and over again. It's the last song of the set, and thus the last live song ever played by Donovan Wolfington. It's called Die Alone. People jump on stage, crowd surf, but as the song comes to its climax, the lead singer Neil falls back into the crowd and lets them carry him away. As he solos, the camera catches him as he tilts his head back and closes his eyes. You can see him in that moment soaking it in. You can see him in that moment saying goodbye. Lost Scene, Nobody's Fault was written and produced by me, Nate Scott. It was mastered by Claire Morgan, who's in a band called New Lions you should absolutely check out. I want to thank Jim and Patrick of Rockin' the Suburbs for hosting this little audio experiment, and all the people I interviewed for their time. If you want to hear any of the songs from this episode, we're going to be making a Spotify playlist you can check out. Thanks for listening, y'all. Be well.